What is the source of quarrels and conflicts among you? Is not the source your pleasures that wage war in your members? You lust and do not have, so you commit murder. You are envious and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. You ask and do not receive because you ask with wrong motives, so that you may spend it on your pleasures. You adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is hostility toward God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. Or do you think the Scripture speaks to no purpose? He jealously desires the Spirit, which he has made to dwell in us. But he gives a greater grace. Therefore, it says, God is opposed to the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Submit, therefore, to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. Be miserable, and mourn, and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to gloom. Humble yourselves in the presence of the Lord, and he will exalt you. Let's pray together. Father, I do pray that as we consider you and your ways today, that we would see more clearly how we can walk in those ways, how we can remain faithful to them, even when we are sorely tested and tempted to move away from them. Father, help us to see not only what is at stake in terms of life on this earth, but what is at stake eternally. Give us a clearer picture of that today, Father, I ask in Jesus' name. Amen. We finished chapter 3. We're moving into chapter 4. And we've chapter 3 where we're talking about the two sources of wisdom. James, the wisdom that comes from above and the wisdom that comes from below. And as we look at this next section, James chapter 4, verses 1 to 10, I want to urge you to keep in mind that earthly wisdom promotes selfishness and produces dissension, which leads to damaged and broken relationships. And you can tell if you're leaning towards or taking advantage of or just plain out and out living according to worldly wisdom by the outcome of your part in conflict resolution. Heavenly wisdom, on the other hand, promotes love. Love for God, love for others, love for what is right and good. And heavenly wisdom produces peace, which leads to healthy and harmonious relationships. And again, we can tell if we're living by heavenly wisdom by the fruit of our lives in terms of conflict resolution, how we deal with conflict. Today I want to talk about conflict in two ways. First, what conflict is and what conflict isn't. This is partly due to the questions that were asked at the end of last Sunday. So I'd like us to look at what conflict is and what it isn't. And then I want to finish today by talking about the necessity of keeping God in the supreme position of Lord over our lives if indeed we want to deal with conflict in a godly manner. And so I've given you a handout. The handout has some scriptures on it. I'm going to refer to those scriptures, but I decided that it would be worth printing them out for you so that you can, if you will, read through them later. encourage you not to read through them now because I'd like you to listen to me. But you can read through them later, even though I'm going to refer to them. And then there is a table. A table is a kind of laid out information in two columns on the last page. And that's where we're going to finish up today, is looking at that table. So let's take a closer look at conflict. And first of all, what is conflict? Conflict at its most basic level is an active, that means an ongoing disagreement or dispute between people or groups of people who have opposing opinions, values, or beliefs. And it's rare that conflict at, say, this basic level breaks a relationship. However, it is likely that it will do at least some damage to the relationship if the conflict continues unresolved. Unresolved conflict, I'm going to say always, it's maybe a risky word, but I'm going to say always creates distance between the parties. Even if it's just your basic garden variety conflict. Beyond the basic conflicts, there are the more serious conflicts that lead to such things as adversarial arguing. That means you're pitting yourselves against the other. It's two sides pitted against each other, and you're arguing things out. And usually when it's adversarial arguing, it often degenerates into derogatory arguing. That means you start putting the other person down. You don't just argue over the points. You bring in, you get your guns out, and your guns are put-downs, and you start slinging put-downs at the other person. This second kind of conflict usually leads to verbal fighting. When you actually start fighting with your words, most of us have enough sense and enough upbringing and manners not to hit the people around us, but we will get into verbal fights. It definitely leads to high degrees of frustration. And when you're really frustrated like that, it easily turns to exaggerated accusations. You've done that 1,000 times maybe they did it 3 or 4. So we start exaggerating things to build the case. We have resort to pretty harsh criticisms. Paint the picture just a tad worse. We bring in reinforcements. That's like, when you bring in the reinforcements, what you end up doing is saying, well, everybody agrees with me about this. Even your own brother or your own sister or your friend knows you're wrong. That's bringing in reinforcements. You can't just stand on your own feet and deal with the other party. You want to bring in reinforcements. Well, things get pretty serious when we start doing that. Certainly this second kind of conflict breeds anger, some pretty severe anger. But it also breeds denial and defensiveness, tears, feeling like a victim. This kind of conflict, not only results in damaged relationships, it easily leads to broken relationships that in many cases aren't put back together. Well, what drives conflict? On the surface, conflict is driven by our methods, such as our pattern of either-or thinking, black and white thinking, right or wrong thinking. We have these very narrow patterns of thinking, and that helps drive conflict. Certainly, our argumentative and verbally unkind or even abusive patterns of speaking, that certainly drives conflict. Conflict is driven by our longing to flee at any hint of anger and fighting. So we start closing down. So one side's closing down, the other side's attacking. That resolves the conflict real quick, doesn't it? No, it doesn't. It just prolongs it. Certainly, on the surface, conflict is driven by our willingness to quickly appease without counting the cost of what our agreements may mean. And that often leads to backing out of those agreements later on. And I would say that on the surface, conflicts are driven by our competitive, I've got to win approach to resolution. All of that to say, on the surface, conflict is driven by our wanting to be heard far more than we want to listen. We want the other person to understand our position. And we use these methods to get the win, but we're not so interested in understanding the other person's position and really hearing the other person out. Certainly, it's driven by our differing views of reality. I think reality is this. My opponent, the other party, thinks it's that. And so we have this difference in perception of what reality is. And when we have different views of reality, we have different ideas of what the solution is. And it's pretty hard to bring those together if we don't find a common reality. And as I said, when you start bringing in reinforcements, that hurts. But you know what hurts more than that is secondary issues. How often do we get into an argument with somebody and it's about a single issue and we start bringing in other secondary issues? We enlarge the conflict. We want to resolve 10 things now instead of just one. So there's no question that on the surface, our methods genuinely drive conflict. And I hope we can see that. And yet, our methods come from somewhere. They don't just come out of nowhere. They're not just magically created for our use. Our methods come from somewhere. And so what I'd like us to see beyond our methods is that it's what's in our heart that really drives conflict. It's what we hope for, what we fear, what we dream of, what we treasure, what we never want to experience again, or what we hope to have over and over again. It's what's in our heart that really drives conflict. And when conflict continues unresolved, and that's really what a conflict is, it's a dispute, a disagreement, a difference of opinion that continues unresolved. It's an ongoing matter. That's what conflict is. We discover what's really in our heart. And we drive conflict more by these things than by our methods, and that is by our selfishness, by our pride, by our impatience, by our felt need to control, by our demand for respect. By our unhealthy longing for acceptance and love. By our fear of rejection. By our use of double standards, one for myself and another for you, instead of justice. We trade justice, in fact, for double standards. By our discontent, by our resentment and unkindness and forgiveness, certainly by our self-rule, these are the matters of the heart that truly drive conflict. So in summary, conflict is an active, ongoing dispute that is not being resolved, at least not in a mutually agreeable manner. And it's driven first and foremost by what is in our heart, and in a secondary manner by the methods we use. And I tell you this because we can learn good methods, but if our heart is not changed, we will forsake those methods when the things that are really precious to us are threatened. So to help you discern your heart condition in any conflict, if you want to look back on a conflict or you're in the midst of one and you want to kind of see where your heart was in that, observe your methods and the fruit of your methods. And ask yourself if you were purposefully working toward a mutually agreeable solution. Mutually. Get that word, a mutually agreeable solution. Or if you are working toward the solution you wanted. What conflict isn't? And this is just as important to understand, because we get into these situations in life, and if we try to treat the things that aren't really conflicts as if they are, we're going to get into trouble. So my purpose for looking at what does not represent conflict is to help us discern the difference and hang on to godly wisdom as we deal with each kind of thing. And this is where we're going to use these scriptures that are on the handout that you have. We are not in an average, ordinary conflict when the issue is of a moral nature, or it's of a life-threatening nature, or when we are being threatened with physical violence, or being asked to do something or approve of something that is contrary to God's commands, or it's of a nature which threatens the safety of the community, or it's something that threatens the purity of the church, such as the overt practice of sin. These are not conflicts. These are issues that need to be dealt with, but not in the traditional, here's how I deal with conflicts kind of way. We are not in a conflict when we're being persecuted for righteousness' sake, whether our persecutors are unbelievers or people from the religious establishment. It makes no difference. And I'm bringing up persecution as something that's not a normal conflict, because Jesus himself told his disciples these words. They come from Matthew chapter 10, verse 23. Whenever they persecute you in one city, he said, flee to the next. In other words, you don't have to stay around and endure persecution. God does not require that of us. If that's your choice, you may do that. If you can't flee, endure it as a solid believer in Jesus Christ. Bring honor to God in how you endure it. But you have the option of fleeing. Christ gave that to his disciples. It's given to us. And he said, for truly I say to you, you will not finish going through the cities of Israel until the Son of Man comes. And so when they try to persecute you, if you want to get out of town, go. And so my point here is that persecution is the kind of trouble that requires something other than our usual methods of conflict resolution. To make the clearer picture regarding what conflict isn't, I want us to look at some Old Testament scriptures and some New Testament scriptures. And though these examples from the Bible may look somewhat like conflict, they are moral issues. They are physical violence issues. They are community good issues. and they are issues that threaten the purity of the church. And interestingly, the best examples in the Old Testament come from the book of Deuteronomy. So I've taken them all from there. Now, I think it's important before we start looking at these scriptures for me to point out that removing the evil from the midst, and that's the statement, purge the evil, remove the evil from your midst, is not a private action, but it's an action against the one who is wronged by the community. It's a community action. And so in the Old Testament, there was the requirement of two or three witnesses. And you had to have two or three witnesses in order to establish guilt, regardless of the integrity of a single witness. You could have the best single witness in the world, but if you didn't have two or three, you were not to apply God's consequences to that deed. You had to have two or three. That made it a community action. It couldn't be a single person action. In the New Testament, if we are going to take action, we are going to bring consequences in the church, it's to be done by the group. Matthew chapter 18 tells us we're to first go privately and call our brother or sister back to their senses and to right behavior. And if they listen, great, it's over and done with. If they don't, take two or three others with you that can call them back to their senses. If that works, great, it's over and done with. If they don't, go to them as a whole church. If they don't listen to the church, then you treat them like a sinner or a tax gatherer. You bring the consequences as a group. So my point is that in these things that are not your typical, ordinary conflicts, by the time we get to the consequences, in most cases, it's a group effort. Doesn't mean every case. There are always those cases where we need to apply it privately, individually, but in most cases, it's a group effort. All right, the Old Testament scriptures, Deuteronomy 13:5. The essence, the basic message is, purge the evil of false prophecy and false teaching from among you. That's protecting the purity of the church, or Israel in this case. Deuteronomy 17, 2-7, purge the evil of idol worship from your midst. And by the way, Colossians 3:5 tells us that even greed is a form of idol worship. Deuteronomy 17:9-12, purge the evil person who will not abide by the verdict of the temple priests. And the temple priests were to act as the supreme court in Israel. So when it got to them, when a case got to them and they rendered the verdict, if the person would not abide by their verdict, you were to purge that person from your midst. Deuteronomy 19:15-21, purge the evil of any witness who knowingly lies or falsely accuses another so as to gain a favorable verdict against their opponent. So false witness was to be purged. Deuteronomy 21:18-21, purge the evil of a son who is willfully rebellious, stubbornly disobedient, unwilling to be disciplined, so that they have this undisciplined behavior. Deuteronomy 22:20-22, purge the evil of immorality from you, whether it's committed by a male or a female. All immorality was to be purged. Deuteronomy 22:23-24, purge the evil of adultery from among you. And Deuteronomy 24:7, purge the evil of kidnappers from among you. All right, I bring these up because I'm trying to help you see from the scripture that there are a number of cases that are not your common conflict. We aren't to deal with them as if they're common conflicts. We deal with them differently. The New Testament scriptures, 1 Corinthians 5:19-13. And in essence, what Paul is saying here is, look, I wrote to you not to associate with immoral people. I didn't mean the immoral people in the world. I meant the immoral people in the church. So remove the wicked man. In this case, it was a man who was living with his mother-in-law. Remove the wicked man from among yourselves. Romans 16:17. The same with 2 Thessalonians 3:6 and 2 Thessalonians 3:14 and 15. If someone doesn't hold to the truth of the scripture that has been given to us, passed down through the ages, we are to keep away, turn away, not associate with such a person. Titus 3:10 through 11. Reject a factious person, someone who just is stirring up trouble within the church, creating division and dissension. So, you know, sides are being taken and there's this war going on. You reject that kind of a person. And 2 John 1, 9 to 11 returns to the others that we've already talked about, and that's someone who is not holding to the truth. Do not receive them into your home. In other words, don't give them hospitable lodging. So my point here is that there is a difference between ordinary conflicts and those situations that are to be dealt with in a manner that is more like, say, a parent and child, or judge and criminal, authority and those under authority. It's more of a direct, we deal with it, we take care of it, we're not here to discuss how we can work this out. Here's the right answer. This is what we do. Those things are dealt with that way. Conflicts are dealt with through methods that help us find mutually agreeable solutions. So as we look at James 4, 1 to 10, keep in mind that we're talking about conflicts. We're not talking about these other matters. We're talking about conflicts. All right, as I stated at the beginning, I want to finish our teaching today by looking at the important issue of who and what is the priority in our lives, or who is the Lord in our lives, or what are the ruling factors when it comes to how we deal with conflict. And if you wish to apply this information to other areas of your life, I certainly want to encourage that. I mean, these are truths that, from my perspective, should be applied in every single area of our lives, but I'm talking about it in terms of conflict today. So that's the goal. So at the top of that table, you see, in relation to conflict, who or what rules over your heart and methods? And this is not an either or. I'm either totally bad or I'm totally good. It's either all God or it's all me. It's not an either or, but a who, what is on top. What rises to the top when you get into conflict or certain conflicts or certain settings? And we have two columns. The column on the left is the column we ought to cling to. The column on the right is the one that often tempts us and pulls us in its direction away from the column on the left. And so at the very top, we want to have God as the supreme ruler over our lives. Now, I understand that we all would agree as followers of Jesus Christ that that's the way it ought to be, but it isn't always that way. When you get into conflicts, or if you help people who are in conflicts, you soon discover what is most valuable to them, who's most important to them, what it is that they are making decisions according to as they're trying to deal with a particular conflict. And my experience is, too many times we are in trouble because we have set God aside and we've raised self to the top and we are exercising self-rule in this conflict rather than exercising godliness according to who God is and what he says. Now, I want to acknowledge that on a temporal, earthly level, it is very appeasing to lift self to the top. And it is very unappealing, did I say appeasing? It's very appealing to lift self to the top, and it's very unappealing to lift God to the top, because it's costly to your self-life to put God at the top. You have to be willing to pay the price. But, as we stated when we were working through the wisdoms, earthly wisdom, heavenly wisdom, you can't get to true peace with earthly wisdom. It is costly to go God's way, but it is the only way to get to true peace. And of course, if God's at the top, we want to keep righteousness at the top and love and heavenly wisdom. And again, love is an easy thing to let slide. Well, not getting love, but giving love. See, we all, when we're in a conflict, it's very easy to fight for getting love. Would we put as much energy into fighting for giving love? Making sure the other person is loved just as much as we want to be loved. Could we put the effort in to find out what they really need to be loved that way? And when righteousness is not at the top, just to pick a biblical way to say it, the flesh, the world, and the devil is at the top. And when love is not at the top, selfishness is at the top. And when heavenly wisdom isn't at the top, worldly wisdom is. All right, what I want to help us see is that we get into these conflicts, and whether we are aware of what we are really doing, the reality is we're pushing something to the top and we are acting accordingly. And if we don't make it our aim to consciously, purposefully, carefully make sure God and righteousness and love and heavenly wisdom are at the top, ruling over our lives, we will easily begin to push them down and push self-rule, the world's way of dealing with things, selfishness and worldly wisdom to the top, and we will be behaving accordingly. Once more, it is costly. It's costly to your self-life. Put God to the top. But think of the worship we just went through. Think of the wonderful things we said about God. Is he not worthy to be kept at the top? Well, what are the results? When we keep God at the top, we make a sincere effort to work with the other person or group rather than against them. How easy it is for conflicts to become adversarial. That means you pit two sides against each other. When you're pitted against each other, one good way to understand the word adversarial is think of the court system. When you go to court, you get a lawyer, and the other side gets a lawyer. And what does the lawyer do? Well, he argues for you, and he presents your side. And how does he do that? One of the primary methods used in court is not just to present the facts, but to present the facts and denigrate your opponent. You understand that? We go to court and we put the opponent down. It's like what we're facing with all these nice candidates who are running for public office. Do they present the facts? Oh, yes, they present some of the facts, but they also put their opponents down. That's adversarial. The lawyers aren't the only ones to do that. You know, you don't go to law school to have to learn that. And the rest of us who miss law school don't know about that. You kind of pick that up as you grow up. Lawyers have just refined it. Maybe some of us have too. When God is at the top, you won't degenerate a conflict into an adversarial setting. You will work your best to keep it in a setting where you are working with the other person rather than against. You know, I think of conflict in the home between a husband and wife or parents and children. Here we are, one family. And yet, what are we doing? We got an issue, we got a dispute, we got a disagreement, things aren't working the way we'd like, and we go against each other rather than saying, we have a problem, let's us work together at resolving it. God's way is to work with rather than against. When we have God at the top, we listen long enough to understand the other side. Now, you know your side, but do you know the other side? Have you listened long enough? When God is at the top, we speak clearly and specifically. That takes practice. You've got to practice that away from conflicts in order to take it into your conflict resolution. It's way too easy to speak in general terms. It's way too easy to know what you want to get across, speak in general terms, believe you've gotten the message across, and the reality is the person listening to you could have taken what you said in any of three or four possible ways because it was so general. There's nothing specific about it. You aren't loving the other person. You aren't putting God at the top and seeking righteousness if you're not speaking clearly and specifically in conflict resolution. And of course, it means seeking a mutually agreeable solution. We're in this together. We'll probably both have to give something up. That's fine. This isn't just a compromise. This is a resolution. It is two people finding a third way. When God is at the top, we tell the truth. But we always tell it with love and respect. Something that really helped me with this was, you know, asking myself, I must have asked myself this 100 times as I thought about how I would carry it out. Could I send somebody who did a heinous deed to my wife or my kids? Could I send them to prison in a respectful manner? Or would I have hate and anger and other things coming out of me as I sent them off to prison? We need to tell the truth, but it should always be with love and respect. And when God is at the top, we invite rather than force or threaten. How long has God waited for me? How long has he waited for you to come to your senses regarding some issue that to him is a burden and a pain and a suffering? And yet he's patiently waited. He's invited. We ought to be inviting rather than forcing or threatening. And if God is at the top and we are the stronger one, then we serve. And if we are the weaker one, then we need to become fearless. In other words, we need to speak up and say what really is our perspective on things. And why would this be the case? Because God is our security. And eternal things are far more valuable than temporal things. Your soul, your character, your relationship to God, it's far more valuable than resolving this conflict. Far more. Well, when self is at the top, look at the other side. We argue, we quarrel, we attack, we fight, we get hostile, we resort to controlling methods, we become verbally abusive. And sometimes people get physically abusive. I hope that isn't true of us. Now, maybe you don't at all fit into that top part of that box. But if self is at the top, you might take a different tact, a different approach. You give quiet resistance, or you try to appease, or in some other way end the discomfort of the resolution process without ever resolving the conflict. That doesn't help things at all. It may end the pain for the moment, but it doesn't solve anything. You may feel mostly innocent or unjustly attacked or unfairly condemned, even though you're part of the conflict, even though you're contributing to the problem. That's what happens when self is at the top. You may pull away emotionally. You may live in denial, so you don't have to pull away emotionally. How about that? When God is at the top, there is forgiveness. We seek restoration of the relationship. Remember I said all conflict does some damage to the relationship. It creates some distance. And so when God is at the top, we not only forgive, but we seek to restore the relationship. And we seek to restore peace. Sometimes conflicts can't be resolved. Sometimes we have to live with them in an unresolved state. If God is at the top, we live with disappointment or sadness, but not anger, not bitterness. And if God is at the top, we can tell the truth to the other party, explain to them how their continuing this conflict damages or hurts the relationship. But again, we want to do it with love and respect. One of the things that has helped me with this is just two words, mad, sad. I want to be sad rather than mad. And I've run that through my head a thousand times, and it helps. It's easy to get mad. It's wiser to be sad. So when God is at the top, I am disappointed. I am sad that the other party will not resolve this conflict. But I don't want to go to mad. I stay with disappointment or sadness. And on the other side, when self is at the top, there's not only ongoing conflict, but ongoing anger or hurt over the unresolved conflict, which builds resentment, unforgiveness, bitterness. It makes us feel like a victim. We quit looking at what our part is, and all we see is what the other side is doing to keep from resolving this conflict and creating this pain in our lives. So we feel like a victim. We focus on how unloved we are, even though we're failing to do our part in resolving the conflict. And sadly, it's very easy to withhold love or affection as punishment to those who don't resolve the conflict with us. Now again, unresolved conflict creates some distance. Things can never be as good as they could be. And we'll talk about this either next week or the week after that, but we need to have the mindset of the father of the prodigal son. He didn't chase his son, but he longed for his son to come home, as was validated by how he responded to the son when the son did come home. That needs to be our mindset. That's what should be in our heart. When self is at the top, that's not how we look at things. We look at things different. And when self is at the top, we may continue to harass or nag the other side until they finally join us in resolving the conflict. I was a real expert at that for many years. And it, like I say, you know, to give up something like that, you have to die to the potential resolution. You have to die to the idea of the conflict being resolved. Godliness has to become more precious to you than the resolution. You understand that idea? All right, when God's at the top, we end up reconciling the relationship and we heal the damage that was done to the relationship. And when you heal the damage, you restore trust. And when you restore trust, you can get to deeper love. When self is at the top, the damage in the relationship continues on. Emotional distance gets bigger. There's a greater loss of trust. And when you lose trust, you always lose some of love. And ultimately, you get a broken relationship. People just don't want anything to do with each other. I'm telling you this for only one reason. We belong to God through Jesus Christ. We know that God is to be the ruler, the Lord, the God of our lives. When we get into conflict, it is way too easy to push God down and raise self up. And if you can see this on a piece of paper, maybe you can think about it in your mind before you get into conflict and while you're in conflict. And make it your aim to keep God at the top throughout the process. And of course, in all things and always, but that's another Sunday. We're talking about conflict right now. Keep God at the top. If you will keep God at the top, you may be tempted to switch sides, but it's a lot easier to stay on the left side of the page. Once you let God slip down or you push him down, you're going to be slipping over to the right side too easily. And the results will show themselves. And you'll see that those results come from switching sides. What is the source of quarrels and conflicts among us? The source is our pleasures, our innermost being, the things that wage war against the members of our body. I encourage you to consider these things that we've talked about today. What is conflict? What isn't conflict? And the necessity of keeping God at the top as we look more thoroughly at James 4, 1-10.